I'm Renee Von Medding. Welcome to Disordered, a podcast about food, our relationship with our bodies, and learning to live and love yourself again. I am not an expert in eating disorders, but I am someone who has lived with one for almost two decades. I'm not here to give medical advice, but simply to try and unpick some of the complexity of disordered eating through a series of conversations I will have with people who are speaking from firsthand experience. Disordered eating will impact each and every one of us at some point in our lives. I want to delve deeper. At what point does disordered eating become an eating disorder? Through looking closer at the spectrum of these mental illnesses, I hope that you will be challenged in your own view of what an eating disorder looks like. This week, I'm speaking to Christina, mum of one from Drogheda, who has a two-tiered experience with eating disorders. She has not only gone through her own experience suffering with an eating disorder, but has also viewed it from the lens of losing a loved one to this mental illness. She spoke to me about her dad, who sadly passed away last year, and her hope that going forwards, others will not have to suffer in silence like he did. So Christina, thank you so much for coming in today, and it's great to chat again. I know we've talked in the past, and it's just really good to sit down. And
thank you for having me.
Yeah, gorgeous day, and looking forward to talking. The way I start out with all my guests is, you know, just tell me a bit about yourself.
So I'm Christina. I grew up in County Louth in Drogheda. I'm 27. I live with my partner, my mum, and our daughter. I'm currently at home with my mum at the moment. She is 2.5.
Your mum or your daughter?
No, my mum is much older, but sorry, mum. I'm 27. I'm at home with my daughter, Ava. I've been at home with her pretty much since I left my job to be with her. Financially, it didn't work for us. It was a long story, but it's working out in the long run. And there's really not that much to me, to be honest. I'm a very average person. I live a simple, humble life.
And did you have siblings growing up?
No, I'm an only child.
Okay.
Yeah. And anybody who has siblings and wish that they were an only child, no, you don't. It's very lonely. I actually used to think that it was called lonely child when I was little. Aww, I used to tell people I was a lonely child.
Sad.
Yeah,
I know.
So Ava has to have some brothers and sisters.
No, it is great to have brothers and sisters. So what was, you know, growing up as an only child, what was your favorite thing to do?
Gosh, I don't really know. Like, I spent a lot of time on my own as a child, truthfully. So I would play with my dolls, or I don't know, go and play with the kids on my street. If you know, it was very, 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 very simple childhood. I'm from quite a small family, so I was fortunate enough to have like really good relationships with quite a lot of people in my family. My grandparents, my auntie, my uncle. But that's pretty much it. And like, even in terms of cousins, I'm the eldest. The next one to me is 10 years younger than me, and I don't really know them that well. So it's really been me. This probably sounds a bit strange, but like, I've been the center of my own world for my entire life, which sounds bizarre.
Do you remember like having a favorite toy?
Barbies. Yeah.
Fucking Barbies.
No, fucking Barbies. A lot of issues with those now, but I was big into my dolls when I was little, and
but I think that's very normal.
Yeah,
you know,
it
to
is
be into,
yeah,
like role play and
exactly. Yeah, and that's what it was. Yeah. I mean, it's just the most dramatic. You wouldn't get it on Coronation Street what happened with my dolls.
Stop. I see it every day now. I hear the conversations in the next room.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Jesus, what are those dolls getting up to?
It's a bit odd.
And did you have a favorite food?
I don't remember having a favorite food. Like, I've thought about this, you know, I didn't ever think of food until it began to become something problematic in my life. I would have been a huge lover of chocolate. I would, you know, if somebody asked me what's your favorite food, I would have said chocolate. But I never had any hang-ups around food ever. Until it started to be pointed out to me that maybe I should.
So many people suffer in silence and feel as though they are not worthy of help. There is this narrative that only those who meet the criteria from a diagnostic point of view are allowed to access support. This is simply not true. If you are struggling in any way with your mental health, eating behaviors, or body image, you deserve as much help as anyone else. There should not be a cutoff point for being allowed the supports you need. You mentioned that food then became problematic. Mm. When was that?
So I would have been 10 or 11. It started when I was in fifth class in primary school. You know, the phrase puppy fat was thrown around quite a lot to me. And I had extended members of the family kind of sitting down with my mom and dad and being like, look, we think you need to feed her much better than you are. They, at one stage, and I think the problem is I was told about all of this. So it became something that festered within me. And one of the things that they said was to stop bringing me to McDonald's, which my mom and dad never did. And it was such a, it just feels like when I think about that, such a dig. And I had a great aunt say things like, yeah, I was chubby at your age too. And this is how you get rid of that. And she would show me these bizarre techniques that aren't even exercises in order to get rid of the excess weight on my body or whatever it was. But, you know, when I look back on photographs of myself at that age, nobody should have said anything like that about any 10-year-old child, because I was not a large child in the beginning. I was an extremely average child.
And even if you were.
And even if I was, it's not their place to say those things. Yeah. And I think that, again, it's such a societal thing. Like, it's something that's ingrained in all of us. Mm. So many of us, that we don't know that we're even doing something wrong. We don't know that we're saying things that can perpetuate really problematic ideologies in a young person's mind. My dad was also suffering massively in silence with his own hang-ups, and it kind of correlates, it's kind of around the same time where his weight was being discussed and my weight was being discussed. And you know, you're now, your ears are pricked to this, so you're listening to what people are saying about others around you too. So when I was in fifth class, my solution to this, because I had absolutely no idea what I was doing, was to simply stop eating. And the way I would, I mean, it's bizarre when I think about it, how I did this and how I got around this and how nobody noticed. But I would get up and not have a breakfast, not bring a lunch in to school. And then when I would come home and when I would have my dinner, because that was the only meal that anybody was actually watching me eat, I would eat that. And then I would go to bed a few hours later and I would repeat that process again the next day. So for the most part, I was eating once a day, which now, I mean, you could call that intermittent fasting. But for a 10-year-old child, that's extremely dangerous. And I carried this on until I was 13 and started secondary school. And in my first few months of secondary school, I was continuing the cycle. And it had gotten, this is a couple of years in, and it had gotten to a stage where people were now telling me the opposite of what triggered this in the first place. And it was, you are wasting away. I had my best friend's mom tell me, you are wasting away. And that was a compliment. Like, that was, oh, it's working. Whatever I'm doing, I must be doing it right. So I had no idea even what weight I was back then. I don't think I even knew what the scales were. I just understood that the size I had been was not good.
It was unacceptable to people, yeah.
Exactly. And like, to people who loved me, you know, like to family members who were so concerned that they would say these things to my mum and dad. And my mum and dad weren't too bothered about it, to be honest. Like, my mum especially was just like, no. But she, you know, she would say, it's just puppy fat.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is damaging. Like, and especially when you get to secondary school, everyone seems to, all the girls I knew seem to have their own issues around body and food. And you're coming into puberty and your body's changing anyway. And it's, I used to look at other girls and think, God, I wish I had her legs, or I wish I had her waist, or I wish I had her face or her hair. It was everything. It was really, really minute details. The shape of her lips, you know. So the one thing that I could control was what I was eating and what size I could be if I applied myself drastically to quite literally starving myself. To the point where I was walking home one day with a friend and I was so lightheaded and so dizzy from hunger, and I had to sit down on the side of the road. And then after that, I started to eat again. Like, I just, you know, I don't remember specifics, but I know that that was a turning point, that I knew that what I was doing was causing me to feel like I had no concentration levels. I was lightheaded all the time, and it just didn't seem to be worth it anymore at that stage. And I would say for a couple of years then, I wasn't too bothered about my food or my body. Not like, you know, probably to the extent that most teenagers are.
Mm.
But it wasn't like I felt like I needed to starve myself anymore. But that would come back to bite me in the arse later on. So,
yeah.
But yeah, that was really the beginning of a long, rocky road ahead of me.
There is no one right way to approach a loved one who may be suffering with disordered eating. It will vary from person to person, and you may have to try a few different approaches before they feel safe enough to speak to you. They may also not be in the right place to accept your offer of help, and that is okay. Educating yourself is the most important thing. Choosing your approach and language from a place of love and kindness is a positive approach to open up a safe environment for the person struggling to accept your offer of help. When things kind of started plateauing and getting better, what set it off again? What happened?
College. Yeah. God. You know, I think back, it's so tricky. College was such a complicated time in my life. You couldn't pay me to go back and do. You couldn't. You just couldn't. So I moved to Galway for college. And, you know, I thought that it was going to be this like wonderful time of my life. I had moved away from home and to the other side of the country, and I was going to meet all of these new people, and you know, I wasn't in school anymore, so I could leave behind certain bitchy conversations, and you know, I was an adult now, and for the most part my friend group seemed to consider me as somebody who was a little bit more mature than them. I was, admittedly. You know, the whole drinking thing was an underage gig for me, whereas for them, for most of them, it was only starting out. And I grew up in a town that had nightlife, and you know, we'd sneak into clubs and stuff. Whereas this, most of them were rural, so they didn't have that experience, and they were so. I was very different to the people that I found myself surrounded with, and was isolated. In a way, just, you know, that I probably mean that like metaphorically isolated. And I really struggled to click with people. And what I found was at that stage, you know, you're a young adult, you're going out all the time. Nights out meant short skirts, tight dresses, high heels, hair done to the nines, fake tan, the works. And you're comparing yourself then to the new people in your life and what they're doing. And I was also living with three great girls. I was very lucky to have them, and I'm still in touch with them. But they had their own hang-ups with things too. And what I actually found was, and I actually was only saying this to my mum last week, you can live with people and not know what's going on in their lives. Because I, you know, and I would include my own parents there too. They had no idea what I was doing. Absolutely none. And it was the same with my housemates. So like, I just found myself in a going into a very dark place in college. I didn't feel like I fit in. I wasn't keeping up with hobbies. I wasn't going into class anymore. I was getting lower and lower and lower. And a lot of that came from my self-image and self-worth all being connected. And I was going out with a guy at the time who used to make really harsh remarks about my appearance. Like, he'd point out if I had a spot in my face. Or I remember one day I said to him, like, oh yeah, I used to be a little bit thinner. And I had been. And he said, what happened? Like, but he said it in such a way that was like, why did you put on all that weight? And, you know, and then he would say things like, oh, the girl who lives in the block over to me, like, she's a great figure. And, you know, it was all of this like, oh, right, okay, so my body's not as great as hers. And this is the guy who I'm going out with and sharing my body with. So my body's not good enough. And I began to go back into that state of starving myself again to lose the weight that he thought I shouldn't have put on in the first place. So,
wow, sounds like a prince.
Yeah. He was a real treat. It didn't last too long, but it came with quite a lot of future insecurities. Mm. But around the same time, just so much stuff was happening in my personal life. So many huge events had taken over my well-being. Mm. And by the time I got into second year in college, I was in a very deep pit of depression. And I ended up transferring colleges from Galway to Maynooth because I simply couldn't hack being there anymore. It was really awful. And at the same time, my parents broke up and my friend killed himself. And it was so many things at once. I ended up going into a job then part-time over the summer where I was treated like absolute dirt. Like, I can't even begin to tell you how bad I felt going into work every day. And I was put on antidepressants and I couldn't afford them because they were so expensive at the time. And I was in college and I was trying to keep up with work and dealing with so many things and moving back home and commuting to college now, not having any friends and not having a social life, not having the nightlife that I had in Galway. And I really spent a lot of time on my own. And the one thing that I can see now that I was doing was latching onto food and my body as a way to have something to control. I didn't know this. I didn't know this until very recently that that's what I was doing. But that's what I seemed to lapse into. And thankfully, and you know, big shout out to my partner because he's wonderful and has been a huge support to me since we started to go out together. I got with him when I was 20 and we spent a lot of time together, and unfortunately I couldn't keep what I was doing from him. And that was at the time making myself sick regularly. And you know, he'd get really angry about it, or I was very passive about like medicine. So like, I didn't care if, you know, I didn't have a cold, I was going to take Benlin for flu anyway because it helped me sleep. Like, I was being just really destructive. I was being really careless with what I was doing to my body. And you know, in December just gone, my aunt had asked me a question. She said, you know, this is really personal, but yeah, did you ever self-harm when you were young? And actually, yeah, I did, because what I did to myself was extremely abusive. I might not have been, you know, doing it in the way you would imagine, but like, yeah, it was really, really dangerous what I was doing. And it was Gary, my partner, who really was like, you can't do this. You know, you have to like really get a grip here.
Christina's experience with a weight loss organization is one which is incredibly common, but unfortunately not spoken about enough. Although these programs can be beneficial for some, for an overwhelming number of people, they are psychologically damaging in the long term. A weight loss club is essentially an organization that financially benefits from people coming back week in and week out. It benefits from people losing weight and then gaining it back again and having to work through the program on multiple occasions. Weight loss organizations do not usually promote exercise as part of the program. Gaining muscle will usually mean weight gain, as muscle is heavier than fat. And weight loss clubs are about weight loss, not necessarily about overall health. It's easy to become fixated on the number on the scales if you are attending a weight loss program every week. Are you the kind of person who is likely to become obsessed? It's important when entering any of these programs that the approach of the organization is beneficial for you, both in terms of your physical health and, more importantly, your mental health.
Which brings me to Slimming World, because I just thought that was the solution. I'll go on to the worst diet ever. And I know that there are people who really commend Slimming World and who really believe that Slimming World has helped them take control of their lives. But what it did to me was set me back astronomically to the point where today I cannot seem to shake the echoes of what it was like to be part of their organization. And I wasn't with them for very long. I didn't start out with them much, you know, much different to how I look now. But what they did, their rules and their just the way they run things was terrible. Yeah, their rules just meant that it just festered in me all of these new ways that I could be destructive with myself.
And so at the point that you joined Slimming World, were you actively, like, would you kind of have thought of yourself as bulimic or?
I would now. Okay. Like, this is the thing. Like, and, you know, I wouldn't have thought so back then. I would never, I've never had anybody say anything to me in terms of like eating disorder or disordered eating. They were not on my radar. This was just something
it
I was
just
doing.
Everyone just, yeah. And yeah. I suppose so many people struggle with similar
exactly.
things.
Exactly.
And no one like, ever classes it as anything.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like, here's my hang up. It's like, oh, you have that hang up. This is mine. But it wasn't all, it also wasn't something we discussed, because I definitely feel like, especially within friend groups, that was a competitive thing with one another. It was like, who could be the most destructive, who could be the skinniest? Who could be the one with the most problems? That's the truth. Like, we were kind of a dysfunctional bunch. But and they did have their hang-ups, and they really had problems too. Like, I would say that at least three of my friends had at one stage in their young lives an eating disorder, not just disordered eating, an eating disorder. But I suppose I never knew where that, I didn't know the difference between the two. And I didn't know, I certainly didn't know when I was in Slimming World that what that was absolutely disordered eating, just to ridiculous measures. But, you know, my first week there, another woman was joining with us, and the coordinator who was running the group, she left the new member circle for a minute. And this woman turned around to me, and she was a larger woman. Mm. She was somebody who felt that she needed to be there. Mm. And her first words out of her mouth was, "What are you doing here?" You know, it was like she was saying to me, "You're too small to be here. You know, your body isn't, you know what I'm trying to say." It's almost like they're looking and saying, "I wish I had your body and don't need to be here."
Yeah.
Which sounds terrible, but that's how it came across. And she embarrassed me. Like, I didn't know what to say back to that. But I stayed with Slimming World for, I think I was with them for about 4 to 5 months only. And in that short space of time, I mean, the first week, you know, I went back, I lost 2 pounds. And my coordinator said, "Oh, I would have thought you would have lost more in your first week." So the second week, I didn't eat anything and lost 4 pence. Because I knew I could do that. And so in 2 weeks, I had lost almost half a stone and was being praised beyond belief. And, you know, the group, you stay for group afterwards. I eventually stopped staying because it was really boring, but also because, you know, there were people there who had, say, lost like 5 stone, and they would come in and they had maybe put on half a pound, 2 pounds in the space of a week. And that was the focus. It was so then you would go around the room individually. The coordinator would lead the class or the group individually and say things like, "Oh, Sally, you're up half a pound this week. What went wrong?" Rather than all the work she did before. And, you know, I can see it now. You know that those people were putting a lot of pressure on themselves behind the scenes, and then being humiliated like that in front of an entire group of people. That by the time I got down to my target weight, big quotes, the day I reached target weight, you become a free member to go. You don't have to pay the 9 or 10 euro, whatever it is, to go, as long as you stay within. So say you've reached a stone bracket. As long as you stay within 3 pounds above or 3 pounds below your target weight, you can remain a free member. But if you go below those 3 pounds, you have to start to pay again and change your target, or above, same thing. And in front of an entire group, the day I reached target and got a badge and a certificate for it, she said, "I think you could go for another 7 pounds. I think that would suit you like really well to be there." And the unfortunate thing about that is I'm a full stone heavier now than where she wanted me to be. And my body, in order to lose the half a stone that I used to be the day I reached target, I had to starve myself to get there. And I was taking laxatives, and I was fallen completely back into like this really, really destructive way of being, that I couldn't do it. Like, there was something in me that was like, I can't do that. I cannot go for another 7 pounds because it took me so much to get here. And I, you know, I did continue to go for a little while after that, and I just kind of found at that stage that, you know, I had never really been sticking to their plan, because I wasn't doing things the way that they say, you know, they've got a book and they've got their rules and stuff. I wasn't doing that. I had never been doing that, but I was telling everybody I was, and I was telling myself I was. And, you know, I was convinced then at one stage, I remember, like, honestly, like, you'd want to see my Instagram from 2016. It's all archived. I can't seem to delete the stuff, but it's not there for people to see anymore, because it's just food, Slimming World, body, before and after pictures. My God, do I regret that? Mm. It's just so sad to look back on. Booty tox. I spent so much money on that feckin' booty tox, and I never did anything.
What you're telling me is like blowing my mind.
Really?
That someone could say to someone, I think you need to lose another 7.
Yeah.
I just, there's so much wrong with an organization that would allow people who I'm assuming have no medical training and no...
They don't.
They're not dietitians. They're not nutritionists. They're not...
No, but they're there to make money, you know?
And the fact that you would be monetarily compensated for starving yourself or doing whatever it took to stay in that bracket that you're told is what you need to be at. I didn't realize that they...
Well, like, I mean, the thing is, I would have thought that maybe it was just that one lady and maybe it was just that one group that I was in, except...
Have you talked to people?
Yes. Yeah. So many people who have come out the other side of Slimmer World to see what I see. And I know that I upset quite a lot of people who are still in Slimming World when I talk about it because they don't see what I see.
Yeah. But and I get it, because if you're in that world and if it... If from your point of view, it feels like it's helping you.
Yeah.
I can understand why people would be protective of that.
Yeah. And I don't want to begrudge people of this either. Like, it's something I'm so aware of. I know that there are people who want to lose weight and who feel that this is so beneficial to them. Like, I actually had somebody say to me last week that, you know, back in 2014 or 15, she was part of Slimming World and she's like, yeah, you know, it worked for me and I lost all the weight and it really taught me how to eat my food. It's all out the window now though, because I've put all that weight back on. But like, is that not what happens? Like, because I didn't know this until very recently, but 95% of diets fail. And in the first 5 years, you put back on that weight. And it's been 5 years since I was in Slimming World. This time, 5 years ago, I was in Slimming World. And I'm not where I was when I started it, but even if I was, it's really not that much of a difference. Honestly, hand on my heart, you probably wouldn't even notice. And, you know, I just feel like what it did, especially with the scales, because the scales is something that, you know, and you'll hear people talk about their bodies who feel more accepting of their bodies or neutral or positive about them, that the first thing you need to do is throw away the scales. Believe me, I have done that. I have done that so many times and I have gone to buy them again because they're accessible that way. And I have hid them from Gary and I have also asked him to hide them from me. And very recently in January was a mind fuck for me because, you know, it's the big month where diet culture comes out and is like, this one.
New year, new you.
Exactly. And this was the first year I could see through it. And I found it extremely challenging. And I am in weekly therapy sessions. They're over the phone at the moment. And unfortunately, as much as I love my therapist, this is not her area. That's what she has told me, that I know more about eating disorders than she does. I spent January doing a mental health course through the Open College and I based it on eating disorders. And, you know, I did very well in that course. 92%. But, you know, because I was so passionate about what I was writing and I was back and forth to my tutor at the time. And I think I was blowing his mind a little bit because I had spoken about Slimming World and I had spoken about certain organizations and ideas like BMI that we all hang ourselves up on and challenged those views. And he wrote back to me at one stage and he was like, is this your opinion or is this research? I mean, do you have anything to back yourself up with here? And I was like, I have a plethora of things to back myself up with here. And, you know, I did really well in it because I could back it up, because I could give the evidence. The research is there. So yeah, January was really challenging. And actually, the person who helped me through January was Jess Brogan, who I met across Instagram. I've never met her in person. I remember one Tuesday having my hour-long session on the phone with my counsellor, bawling my eyes out and not getting anywhere with that conversation. And I love my counsellor. Like, I have no intention of leaving her. And a 4-minute voice note that Jess sent me on WhatsApp completely changed my day. And it really helped me. And she's a wonderful person. Like, she really helped me in the last year. She was probably the first person I reached out to share what I was going through, because I didn't know that I was going through anything until somebody pretty much shattered the glass. And it was my friend, my oldest friend, somebody I know who cares for me more than most people on this planet, sat me down last February on Valentine's Day. I met her and another friend for coffee and that other friend left and she said, you know, she's like, you're saying quite a lot of things about yourself today. That's kind of bringing up red flags for me. And she was so kind. Like, honestly, when I talked to her about this, she's like, oh God, I don't even remember what I said or how it came across. But she said, I think you might have an eating disorder. And I was like shocked that she would even say that. I just kind of laughed that off. It's like, no, I don't. Like, and she was going, well, you know, this is what you do, or like, this is how you behave. And I went home to Gary that night that she said that to me. And I was so like laughing it off. I was so like, you know, she said to me today that she thinks I have an eating disorder. And he very blankly looked at me and was like, well, yeah, you do. And I was like, what? And he was like, no, you do. Like, and he was like, think about this or think
about
that.
So it's not something you had ever actually talked about?
Never.
Okay.
Like, not with once Gary, in my entire life with anyone. Have with I anyone? Ever okay. used those words yeah. with anyone? And even now, I would still find it very hard to say that for a period of time, this is what I did. You could call it this. And for another period of time, well, you could call it something else. Because is it not just one thing that you struggle with? Or can you jump from one to another? Or is it an eating disorder? Is it just disordered eating? Mm. And I found the last year really challenging with all of these views because this is when it came to light for me. And so I started to diversify the people I was following online. I started to recognize what was damaging to me and unfollowed or muted if I needed to. I began to feel really sorry for some people too that I could see were struggling. And one person in particular really stands out to me. And eventually they came to say themselves, I have a problem, you know? And it's like, oh, that's amazing that you can come to that conclusion. How hard it must be, do you know? It's so, so hard. I found it incredibly challenging. And, you know, even now, I would not say that I'm in a great headspace with this stuff. I'm battling it all the time, these thoughts, these... trying to like resist the compulsions that I used to do quite a lot. Or, you know, I'm also a role model to somebody now, and I do not want her to hear me talk about myself so badly, which I do all the time. My counselor says, Nats, negative automatic thoughts, she said, you need to combat them with, when you say one bad thing about yourself, you need to retaliate with five positive things, which I find really hard to do. So I'll be like, I like my ears, I like my shoe size, or, you know, like just like really simple things that I'll repeat to myself. But it is important, and it's really important when you've got somebody small watching you, that you don't pass on your insecurities. You know, I'm so conscious of it. I actually walked into her room a couple of weeks ago, and she was in front of the mirror hugging her body, going, I love my body. I was going, wow, like, that's amazing. And like, she's picking that up from me, because I make sure to say those things in front of her, even if I don't really feel it. And that's the truth. And you know, yesterday she said that I had a big tummy, and I was like, that's okay, my tummy is bigger than hers because she's two. Do you know what I mean? Or like, it can be really, and like, I mean, Peppa Pig is banned in our house. It's not allowed.
Don't even get me started.
Daddy Pig gets such a difficult time from the family. The fat shaming in it is actually disgusting. It's not allowed on in our house anymore. And every time, because she used to love it, and she still asks me, I want to watch Peppa, Mommy. And I'd say, Peppa's asleep. Peppa's in bed. Peppa's asleep. So, you know, and she still plays with the toys that she has of Peppa and things, but it is there. Like, you know, last year I went through a phase of like... rewatching some of my favorite movies from like the early 2000s, and Jesus Christ, like, they've all got fucking problems. It's just like, you know, I need to lose Mean Girls. I want to lose 3 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, and then like, she puts on a fat suit for a big bum and that, and it's not even a big bum. Like, it's just girls who eat their feelings and girls who don't eat anything. It's all there. It's all there. And I'm reading, well, I read I don't know if you've read the Oh My God, What a Complete Aisling books. It's really funny. Like, I really enjoy them. But in the first three books, she's always banging on about Weight Watchers and how her, you know, coordinator would be onto her about what she's eating. And actually because I'm listening to that, I'm like, oh, I really hate this part of the books. I really hate that they've included this. But in the most recent one, somebody in the book, in a larger body, pulls the main character up about this. And she's like, how do you think I feel when you are talking about how bad you look or how your relationship with food is when I look like this and you look like that? And I was like, there it is. That's fantastic to put in there. Thank you. It was like, yes, that is what we need to be talking about. That's what we need to hear. And I'm very conscious now of how I talk in front of others too. because as women, we greet each other with, wow, you look amazing. Mm. You have you lost weight? And I love your hair. I love your outfit. Where did you get it? It's all about how we look.
It's all physical, yeah.
Exactly. Every time. And you don't even know that you're doing it. And there have been times where I have done it and went, oh, fuck, I shouldn't have said that, you know? Or, you know, I have one friend and she can say to me, I do think I have an eating disorder. I do think because I'm on the scales all the time and I'm in a calorie deficit every day. And, you know, but I still eat, though. I still have the Chinese at the weekend. I just know I'll go for a run and burn it off the next day. And it's like, oh, it's like, yes, that's a problem. Like, and yeah. If your life is consumed by it, which mine certainly was, and often still can be. That's a problem. Like, why is something so simple as feeding ourselves such a complex issue in society? Why are there so many diets out there? If they worked, surely we'd all be on the same one, do you know? I find it really hard, and especially navigating discussions around people in larger bodies.
Through this series, we've seen how those who live in larger bodies can often be ridiculed and their mental and physical health concerns not taken seriously. They are faced with weight stigmatization, and medical complaints are often dismissed and blamed on their size. Listening to Christina talk about her dad and the final years of his life is really tragic. He was a much loved father who was suffering in silence and couldn't see a way of getting his life back. He was humiliated due to his size instead of being given the help he needed to recover. Ultimately, he needlessly lost his life due to the lack of support.
My dad was somebody with an eating disorder. He had binge eating disorder. He was in a much larger body. It was a very gradual process for him in the beginning, and then all of a sudden it got really bad. And I know how he was treated because I grew up listening to it from people. Are you going to finish that? Are you really going to eat that? Should you really have that much to eat? What did you eat today? You know, you're the size of a house. You're this, you're that. Your belly is the comfiest pillow. It's, do you know, like, and he had an incredibly low self-esteem. I could see it. My whole family could see it. He compensated in other ways. And it was really hard for him to ask for help for anything. It doesn't matter what it is. And, you know, he unfortunately passed away last year in May. We're coming up to the year anniversary next month. And he had type 2 diabetes, which his doctor told him was a result of his lifestyle and that he needed to control his lifestyle in order to control the diabetes. And he couldn't do it. That's the truth. I think he was so far gone at that stage into his own struggles. And it was such a silent thing for him as well. It's so obvious to me now. It's so obvious to me now. But it was so... yeah, it was difficult. And I think how he was spoken to really contributed to how he felt about himself and, you know, why bother? You know, why bother trying to control what I'm doing here? Why bother trying to change my lifestyle when I'm never good enough? I do think that that's what it is.
Do you think that he ever thought that he had a problem?
Well, my mum had said it to him. She had said a few years ago, I think you have an eating disorder. Yeah. And she actually, for Christmas, bought him some sort of, it was a voucher for some sort of motivational clinic.
Mm.
And he never used them. And at the time they were separated, and my mum and dad were separated for 4 years, but they did repair their marriage. And in that 4 years, when he wasn't living with us, things got really bad for him.
Mm.
And we could see it every time we'd see him, how difficult things had gotten for him. He had moved back home with his parents very late into his life. You know, it has to have been confidence, you know, like his confidence was floored, and there's a lot of humiliation and embarrassment that comes with something like that. And then having to tell people that your marriage has ended, or, you know, thankfully they were able to prepare that, because it has meant so much to my mom now with him gone that they were together. But she used to worry. She used to tell me all the time, she used to worry that he would die in that house and that nobody would know, because he lived in the upstairs floor and he was on his own quite a lot, and he became so reclusive and so in on himself. He wouldn't come and meet us. He wouldn't. I remember the day of my graduation for college, you have 2 tickets to bring people with you, and I wanted my mum and dad to come, and the day before he cancelled. And, you know, my mum was really upset about that because it was something for the 3 of us and the end of my college experience. And it later, you know, we realized later that the reason he didn't come was because he didn't have anything nice to wear. He didn't fit into any of his clothes. And, you know, he passed it off like, I have a really bad headache. Mm. I didn't hold it against him. I was never angry at him for that. I knew what stage of his life he was at that stage, at that time. I remember once my grandmother saying to me, your dad's room is a mess up there. She's like, I can't get him to clean it. Like, he's in his late 40s and he's been told by his mother to clean his room, like, you know. And I went upstairs one day when he wasn't there and I opened the bedroom door and it was really bad. Like, it was really, really bad. It was the sign of somebody who, you know, their environment was what was going on inside their heads. And I said it to him. I was like, Dad, like, it's really bad up there. So the next time I went up to see, the door was locked because he didn't want, you know, like, and, you know, I had completely crossed over a boundary with him, just invading his space that way. It is something I regret, but it also worried me, you know. And I actually asked my dad to join Slimming World with me. It was around the same time. The day I reached my target weight on Slimming World was the day my dad joined, and he was met with a room full of women. Not men. There were maybe one or two men in the time that I was there who went to the groups, but they weren't there that day. And he was significantly larger than most people in the room. And I'll never forget his face when he stood up on the scales. I was down the other side of the room, but I was watching. And he was so upset. Like, you know, he was so, it was like he was trying to make, you know, he was saying to the person who took his weight, oh, I didn't know it was that bad. You know, like, and it was awful. And you have a little book and they write down your weight every week. And I didn't ask him what it was, but we went back over to my grandparents' house afterwards and I peeked at his book. And, you know, I never told him that. Nobody knows that I did that. My mom does. I told my mom that later on. But in his first week, he lost half a stone and then he stopped going altogether. And I don't blame him. When I look back now, because at the time I thought Slimming World was great because, you know, I was losing so much weight in Slimming World. I was fucking starving myself to do it. Mm. But, you know, I was sticking to the plan. It was bullshit. And I'm really sorry that I ever brought him there. I'm really sorry now that I didn't have the knowledge that I do now. And I still don't think I have it all. Like, I don't feel like I know everything. I certainly don't feel like I know enough to even really help myself. But I at least would like to think that I could have had the opportunity to sit down and talk to him about my own struggles and maybe encourage him to talk about his. But instead, he was met with criticism instead of support. And I didn't know about eating disorders. I didn't understand that he had one. I didn't know where to look for help. Unfortunately, a lot of larger people will be met with weight stigmatization through healthcare services, and he often was. They're dismissed by GPs. Every problem they have, you need to lose weight, you need to lose weight, you need to lose weight. And he was certainly met with that. Like, the diabetes was that. Mm. Dad didn't suffer with diabetes too long. It runs in our family. But he was diagnosed in 2018. That's when I was pregnant. And he died in 2020. So 2 years. And 2 years of him, you know, to us, my mom would say, like, he was really trying, like, he was really making an effort. But to me, an eating disorder, what you do with that in private, nobody knows about and nobody sees. So while they might make it look like they're doing well and that they're prioritizing their health, blah, 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 actually behind closed doors, it's a completely different story. And the day after my dad's funeral, I knew from the time I did see his room, which would have been like 2 or 3 years beforehand, maybe even longer, I knew that that room was going to be really bad. Mm. And I knew, you know, I had family talking about, you know, don't worry about it, Christina, we'll go over and we'll clear it out. And I was saying no, because I did not want them. I did not want him to be judged. Mm. I didn't want them to look at him differently. I didn't want him to feel embarrassed. I knew about it already. So it was like, I can do this for him. And I am not a spiritual person. Mm. I'm just going to put that out there. What you hear next, I still don't think is a spiritual thing. I've always had wacky dreams. And I find great comfort in them. Don't get me wrong. If somebody who's passed away comes to me in a dream, I'm like, deadly. But yeah. I don't believe anything to do with the afterlife. But the night of his funeral, I had a dream that I was driving over to my grandparents' house where he had lived, and that I couldn't see him, but he was in the back of the car with me and he was talking to me and he was saying, it's not as bad as it looks. It's not as bad as it looks. And that when I went into the house and opened up the doors upstairs, he had the whole top floor, that the rooms were spotless, that they were gleaming, that they were glistening, that the, you know, it was so peaceful. But in reality, the next day when I went over, it was far worse than I could have imagined. Mm. And I spent the guts of 3 weeks clearing out that room and organizing. And what I found was a very lonely, very depressed man who had really succumbed to the thing that held him back in life. And that was his insecurities with food and his body. There was absolutely no food in that room. There was no food, but there were a lot of wrappers. Mm. And recently I was scrolling through Instagram and I don't remember what page it was. It might have been Intuitive Eating Ireland, where the picture on the grid was, where do you hide the wrappers? Mm. And I couldn't believe it. Mm. It stopped me dead in my tracks. And I was going, and the whole post was about binge eating disorders and about shame and about planning binges. To this day, if you go up into our attic at home, you will find bags of wrappers. Mm. In our home, even growing up, if you put your hands down the sides of the sofas, you would find wrappers. After he passed away, there was a day where I was sitting in my mum and dad's bedroom with my mum and we were talking about him, and she said something, oh, I think that's in his locker there. And I opened up the locker and just wrappers, just they all came out. Because, and you know, I think about that and I'm like, he was hiding them, because if he put them in the bin, we would see and we would know. And, you know, my friend's mother worked with him in the same place. And she told me years ago, you know, your dad's lunch, she'd say, is like, you know, a bit concerned about him because he's eaten XYZ. And, you know, I'm really trying to like break away from the food labels of what's good and bad for you, or what's junk food, or, you know, what's going to contribute to high cholesterol or diabetes. Like, it's just, but, you know, we were really concerned. And for a long time, this sounds ridiculous, like, but for a long time, I used to imagine my dad's funeral. I used to wonder and worry if he was going to be around for long. His friends, his two best friends, lost their dad in a similar way when their dad was 48. And his two friends would often sit down with him and say, we're worried about you. My mom would sit down and say, we're worried about you. And he'd say, there's nothing to worry about. There's, you know, I'm trying my best. I'm trying my best. And dad was 52. And, you know, I remember the night it all happened, the paramedics asked a few questions and, you know, we said cardiac arrest, and they said any underlying health conditions, and we said diabetes, and they said okay, and they were very like, okay, we can put this together, this is like really common. And you only had to see how he was living his life to understand now how things had gotten so bad. And you know, it's so difficult to now look back on, honestly. It's so hard. And if he was here, he'd be so upset. Like, honestly, he would be so upset. He'd be devastated that I saw that room. Mm. He would be devastated that we're so devastated. He'd hate to think that he caused us any pain. But really, I'm just so sorry that we caused him so much pain. Mm. Because we definitely did. And I put myself there too. I have said things to my dad as well that I really regret saying about his size and about his body.
But you didn't know any better.
No, I didn't, but I do now. And that's of hindsight. Is just, it's so bittersweet because...
But I think that's why it's so important to be talking about it, because...
I totally agree.
Maybe someone else...
You know, when I knew I was coming here to talk about dad, like, I'd say to Mom, okay, I've been given this opportunity to talk about dad and to talk about what he went through. And I said, is there anything that you don't want me to say? Is there anything that you feel like we need to keep from everyone? And she said, no, you need to tell them everything. You need to give people the opportunity to hear this, because men suffer from eating disorders too.
As we've seen over the last number of episodes, recovery looks different for everyone. Even if you have educated yourself on the work needed for recovery, it's an entirely different process to applying the knowledge you have learned and changing your habits and behaviors. Letting go of something that you've spent so much energy on, even though you know it is unhealthy, can be a very difficult and brave process. What is your understanding of recovery? Christina mentioned something I believe is so important and is something I hope this podcast will help anyone out there struggling in any way to understand. No matter where you are in your journey, or whether you are supporting someone in their journey, you are not alone. If we can understand this, maybe no one will have to suffer in silence or feel shame for suffering.
I wanted to ask you about, and I think we've kind of touched on it already, but what would you kind of say to people who, you know, have a loved one who is struggling? Mm. Or on the flip side, maybe struggling themselves, because obviously you come at it from both points of view.
The most cliche thing in the world is that you are not on your own if you are struggling. And the most beneficial thing that anybody can do is simply reach out and ask for help. It's so hard. I think people really can undermine just how difficult it is to ask for help. And that goes across the board for so many things in life. Yeah. But particularly if it's taking over your life, if it is debilitating your life, that is more than likely a really good indicator of now is the right time to ask for help.
Yeah. And I know, like, personally, the first time you ask is going to be one of the hardest things to ever do. But the first time you ask is the only time it's going to be that hard.
Yeah, that cliche, problem shared and all that kind of stuff.
But it's true. Once you kind of get a bit of that weight off, like, wrong word to use, but like, you know what I mean? If you get that off your chest and, you know, you say it to another human being, even if you don't know that person, even if it's just online. And I've had people reach out to me online and say, I've never said this to another person, but now I've said it to you. And that is the first step in being able to actually talk to the people that you know, and your family and your friends.
I could not agree more.
You know, being able to go and talk to your GP, like, unfortunately, like, a lot of GPs don't have the training in this area, but they are usually the first point of call if you are looking to get help.
I think, unfortunately, with a lot of GPs, no matter what the issue is with your health, if you are in any way overweight or the response can often be, you need to lose weight.
Yeah.
Even when that's not what you're going in for, even when it's got nothing to do with it. And that is where weight stigmatization comes into it. And when the people that you are really relying on, like your GP, to talk you through what you need to do next, and their response is to shame you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think at the point that I accessed help through my GP, thankfully I was able to do that. But I did feel like I was kind of almost brushed aside because my weight was not low enough at that point. Mm. And it was like,
that's really bad.
Is this really a problem?
No, I'd be passionate about this kind of stuff. Like, how much of a problem do you need to have for it to be problem enough? Like, if you see somebody really, really spiraling, but they don't meet the criteria, why are we waiting until they do?
Yeah.
You know, it's the same with
and
a lot of
things. And some people will never meet the criteria. Like, exactly. You know, for someone like me who was binging and purging, that's kind of the perfect balance to kind of maintain a weight. And that person may never meet the BMI criteria for treatment. And I was just kind of lucky that I was able to access that through the public system. But I remember some of the therapists I had to see initially were shocking.
It's really interesting that you're saying that, though, because for anybody who is searching for therapy, the first therapist you meet may not be the one. It's okay. There's plenty more fish in the sea. Keep looking for them.
I went through three ones before I landed with the one that was right for me. But I had to kind of sit through sessions with people who I found quite offensive and quite unhelpful.
Yes.
Dismissive.
When I was really low, when I was in university, and it was during a very heavy period of my life where I was binging and could not get myself out of bed to face the day ahead of me, the therapist that I saw told me, do you think maybe you should join the gym?
Wow. And the therapist knew why you were...
Oh yeah, like, she said, she didn't actually think that it sounded like I had a problem. She said, it sounds like you might be a bit lazy. Her words.
Wow.
I never went back. I still had to pay for those sessions, but I never went back. I think I signed a contract for like 6 sessions and I went to see her 4 times and still had to pay for the other 2.
Wow.
But the therapist, and the following therapist wasn't great either, but the therapist I'm with at the moment, who's my 3rd one, is amazing. And I feel so lucky to have her, and she was worth the shit to find her. Do you know what I mean? And I look at her now and I'm like, oh my God, please don't ever leave here. Like, just, I'll go wherever you go. Do you know? Yeah. And I think it's really worthwhile mentioning that, because I've known people who have finally gone to ask for help and have met the wrong person and have not gone back to look for
because
help.
Because they think that that's they what help looks like.
They had a terrible experience. And it doesn't matter what I say, you will find the right one. Just keep looking. No. Yeah. They've really been shot in the foot there. Like,
it's kind of like dating, isn't
yes, it? It is quite like dating. And then
you might not meet the right one first time around.
Just don't fall in love with your therapist, okay? Yes, but yes, I totally see the connection there. But finding the right therapist may not happen straight away. It is worth it if you keep searching. It's so heavily included in my relationship with food, but I have always said that I think I'm the type of person who's driven by guilt in so many ways. Motherhood was a kick in the teeth when it came to guilt, and with food it was always about guilt and punishment. My therapist would say, you have no compassion for yourself. Why do you have so much compassion for everybody else but you can't give yourself an ounce of it? Do you know what I mean? And it's like, that's what I'm trying to do right now. And so if I overeat, which we all do, like, it's life, just enjoy it. If you're not enjoying it, please ask for help. But you know, if I do that now, I don't sit back and go, okay, you are a bad person and your body is worthless. And I just kind of observe with no judgment. That's really hard to do.
Yeah.
And I still struggle to do that. And some days I feel like I bomb it. Like, some days I think, like, this is great, I'm having such a good day, I'm never going to feel like that ever again. And then two days later, this doesn't feel so good. And then I feel like a fraud.
The internet can be a very powerful tool to connect us with, really helpful content that we need to see. And if we lived in an age where we didn't have that, like if you lived in an age where you didn't have any of that, you might not have been able to access the help that you needed this year.
Absolutely. And I think about that too. Like, and I think, you know, years ago, before there was internet, we had a tribe of people, you know, you knew who you knew, and your circle didn't really go that far. And so what we knew was limited.
Sure.
Now, like, I'm overwhelmed by everything that I learn online. This year has been really tough online, with just so much global things happening that I've often felt either very guilty for not understanding everything all at once or so overwhelmed that I can't look at it anymore. I can't do this right now.
Yeah. It can be very overwhelming, but it's can be a very important tool in our personal kind of development and learning and educating ourselves.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming in and talking to me. I feel really honored that you chose to talk to me.
Well, I feel really fortunate to have come across you in the first place. So thank you so much for having me. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. And I hope I've done my dad proud in a way too.
But that's one thing, like, wherever he is, he, you know, is proud of you. And he, you know, you could not have changed how things panned out, no matter how much regret or guilt there is there. Like, those feelings will not change things. Like, that was just your journey, and the way that things did happen, like, you absolutely being like an outspoken person will now make sure that other people don't have to go through
that is good
that has come from that.
I'll carry him and I'll be his advocate, and that's all I can do. So thank you very much. I really, really appreciate that.
If you need medical advice, please speak to a professional. You can contact Bodywise, the national charity for eating disorders in Ireland, on 01 210 7906. Or you can get in touch with the Marino Therapy Centre, specialists in eating disorder recovery, through their website on www.marinotherapycentre.com. Thank you again for listening, and I hope that this conversation has been helpful to you in some way. I'm Renee Von Medding, and this has been Disordered.